topic for this morning, Mishkan and Shabbos, or as I titled it, what makes a Mishkan breaks a Shabbos. I figured it's Parshas Truma, we're building the Mishkan, and fits the theme. By way of introduction, I think actually Hadassah was there. I gave a shiur 2 years ago, I think, at a Malava Malka. 2 or 3 years ago, one of the Malava Malka shiurim. Oh, you know what? No, Jeremy was there. You weren't there. About CRISPR and the issue of genetic editing. So there we talked about the question of, among other things, how Judaism looks at not just PGD, where you're analyzing and deciding, you know, which embryo to implant, but actually CRISPR, where you would be tampering with the genetic sequence. And I showed two different views here, represented in the first and second source. First one from Rav Soloveitchik. He says, the scriptural portion of the creation narrative, meaning where the Torah tells you about Bereishis, is a legal portion in which are to be found basic, everlasting halachic principles. Don't make the mistake of thinking that the Torah begins with nice stories. He says, the Torah begins with halacha. Bereishis is halacha. If the Torah then chose to relate to man the tale of creation, we may clearly derive one law from this manner of procedure, that man is obligated to engage in creation and the renewal of the cosmos. He says, when the Torah begins with Hashem being creative, it's a mandate for us, as those who are supposed to walk in Hashem's ways, that we should be creative as well. And this is part of a school of thought that says that human beings, Jews as those who follow the Torah, are supposed to take advantage of whatever abilities Hashem has given us to manipulate the world, so long as we stay within the bounds prescribed in the Torah. So kilayim is still off limits. I'm still not allowed to graft things, you know, cross species. There are rules for what I'm allowed to do. Nonetheless, whatever doesn't break those rules is assumed to be okay. That's one school of thought. On the other hand, Rabbi Lau Sr., he says in number two, the moment medical science tries to take upon itself duties in areas which are not its responsibility, such as shortening life, cloning, or creating life in an unnatural way, we must set down borders in order not to harm the Jewish basic belief that there is a creator of the universe in whose hands life and death are placed. So, clear limits, not based on this is in violation of a halacha, but that there's a basic principle that life and death are in God's hands. Obviously, shortening life does directly contradict the halacha, right? Votes yirtzach. However, creating life in an unnatural way is a very vague term, right? What exactly does that mean, and what are you violating? Would this apply to IVF? Would this apply to the artificial uterus? What exactly would this apply to is not clear. And what halacha are you violating? He just says, those things are in God's hands. I actually got last night, Rabbi Dr. Reichman, who was here and spoke for us back in November, so he emailed me last night. He just finished his annual Purim Torah, and it's about the artificial uterus. And it's sponsored by Ziploc. He's got all these jokes about, you know, like something like, maybe I'll forward it to the group. It was something like, now the bag that you raised your children with can be the bag you raise your children with, or something like that. It's very funny. Like, you have to read it. But there was that. There was Uber. It was very very interesting. In any case, the point here is you have two opposite presentations. One on behalf of creative activity, apparently with very little bounding it, and then the other saying, no, there are areas that are for God. So this question may seem like it's most relevant for, you know, cutting-edge bioethics, and I suppose on one level it is, but it's actually relevant for everyone in their daily lives, as expressed in the issue of the Mishkan and Shabbos. So let's see why this is relevant. Who built the Mishkan? Batal is the project manager. Who built it? The Jewish people, as a whole, every step of the way, right? We were the ones who collected the materials and donated the materials. We were the ones who created the structure. We created the kelim. We created the clothing for the kohanim to wear. When it comes time to actually dedicate it, we perform the avodah. It's not magic, right? Hashem doesn't plop a mishkan down in the midbar. Hashem does not tell us, okay, now that you've created it, I'm going to be the one to dedicate it in some way. Like, it's all for us to do. There are things about it that are supernatural, right? We're told that you can't just make a menorah. It's this one piece of gold, and Moshe can't figure out how to do it, and Hashem tells him how to do it. But fundamentally, it's all placed within human activity, and Hashem Davka gives human beings control of the process. If you take a look on the sheet, at source number 3, this is from the Ramban, when the Torah says, the pasuk he's commenting on is from Kisisa, that those who helped to create the Mishkan were called Ish Asher Nisa Olibo, those whose hearts elevated them. So Ramban writes, it says this only about the craftsmen, that their hearts elevated them. We don't find elevation of the heart regarding those who donated the material. It only says they were generous. The idea of whose heart elevated him to draw near to the labor is that no one among them learned the tasks from a teacher or from someone who trained his hands at all. They didn't apprentice to somebody else, but he found in his heart that he knew how to do this. His heart was elevated in the ways of God to come before Moshe and say, I'm going to be the one to do it. In other words, Hashem endows them with the ability to do it. But it's still not Hashem creating it. For some reason, Hashem wants it to work through us. And whether that's the women who are described as building it, or the men who are described as building it in their own roles, it's something where, you know, Rosh Rafael Hirsch has something. I didn't bring it on the sheet because I was into the, you know, one pager. But Rosh Rafael Hirsch has this idea, which is very similar to what we've said on other occasions from the Rambam about Ruach HaKodesh, that that we already had sort of the intellectual underpinnings to do it, and Hashem just gives us a boost in order to inspire the Jews to do it. And Moshe wants to take part in this physical act of construction. If you look at number 4, I think we've talked about this Medrash on other occasions, we learn that Moshe was upset that he had not personally taken part in building the Mishkan, as the materials had been donated by the Jews, the work had been performed by Bezalel, Aholiab, the craftsmen. Because Moshe was upset, Hashem hid information from the people and they couldn't make the Mishkan stand, so that Moshe is going to have to be the one to actually put it up. And we find in Parshas Pekudei, Moshe is the one to assemble the Mishkan, because he wants a role in this. There's some value in being a physical creator, doing the jobs that the nation did. Clear? Straightforward? So far, so good. Okay. Then you get to Shabbos. And Shabbos is the opposite, right? On Shabbos, we're not allowed to engage in malacha. We're not allowed to create. But not only that, we know that the 39 malachas of Shabbos come from where? The Mishkan, specifically. The actions involved in creating the Mishkan are the actions that you're not allowed to perform on Shabbos. Take a look at number 5. You'll see it in the Gemara. Ein chayavin ela ha-malacha shakiyotze ba ha-isa v'mishkan. You're only liable on Shabbos for malacha, which is like that which was done in the Mishkan. So they planted, you don't plant. They harvested, you don't harvest. They picked up the beams from the ground and put them on the wagon. You shouldn't bring from public areas into private areas. All of the laws for what we can't do on Shabbos are part of this construction and maintenance of the Mishkan. One might note, by the way, harvesting in the desert is a little bit dicey. It's not so easy. So, you know, how exactly this corresponds to specific actions taken in building the Mishkan is discussed. But that's sort of a side point. I just, you know, highlight that issue. But we're not allowed to engage in the activities of the Mishkan, Dafka, on Shabbos. Specifically the malachas that were involved there, but not just now, but even in building the Mishkan. They weren't allowed to build the Mishkan on Shabbos. That was the rule. If you look in the first half of number 6, I might have thought that building the Beis HaMikdash would override Shabbos, No, because the Torah says, Es Shabso Sai Tishmoru Umikdashi Tirao. Guard my Shabbos, revere my Mikdash, Kulchem Chayav Bichvodi. All of you have to honor me, Hashem says. In other words, it's my Shabbos and it's my Mikdash. So I don't want you building the Mikdash on Shabbos. My Shabbos comes first.
That kind of makes sense, because now, like, Shabbos is a break from creation, right? So,
right.
If you're creating the Mishkan, they also need to take a break.
So it's an opportunity, in other words.
It's an analogy.
Mm-hmm.
As in, the seventh day was when God stopped with the creation, so...
So you stop with your creation.
Yeah.
That's true, but I might have made the argument that I am making this for Hashem, right? Therefore, somehow it should have priority. Consider this. In the Mishkan itself, once it's up and running, you bring Karbanos on Shabbos. That's Shechita. That's fire. I mean, like, all the rules get broken. And we're going to talk about that. It's in just a moment. But I find this really odd. That the actions involved in making the Mishkan are specifically not allowed on Shabbos. I wrote an article about this a couple of years ago, and framed it the following way. I just pulled it out of my article, but again, you know, couldn't fit it on the one pager. But imagine the following. Sarah and David plan their home. Sarah designs the materials, the structure, the furnishings, the clothing, and she says, when the structure is complete, I'm going to live there. But then Sarah requests of David, you remember all those tasks I assigned to the workers? Each week, we're going to have a one-day retreat. Don't perform any of those tasks. Right? Why is Sarah opposed to witnessing the deeds she personally commissioned for her sanctuary on her special day? Right? It's like, all that stuff you did, I don't want to see it. I don't want to know from it. I would have thought the opposite. I would have thought that, like, you know, just the opposite. Like, on the anniversary, they should dafka recreate it. Like, there should be some way to remember all the actions, especially when these were mitzvahs. Right? These were good things. If you think of the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Zacharti la chesed ni'urayich, right? Hashem says, I remember the chesed, your chesed, from when you were young, you followed me out into the midbar. So I would have thought that the day that's special for the Jews to bond with Hashem would be the day when, dafka, you recreate it. You should do it. I mean, Goli, your point is correct that it's a day of rest. I would have thought this would be more important. And now to come back to that point, Shabbos and Mishkan do indeed coexist. First of all, Shabbos is supposed to be about Hashem being among us, right? Hashem is with us on Shabbos. Well, the Shechina is in the Mishkan. Shabbos and the Mishkan both reflect a sense of mora, a sense of reverence for Hashem. If you look at number 6, the second half of it, the Gemara points out, Yochol Yisyarei Adam Mimikdash. I might think that a person would have a mitzvah of revering the Beis HaMikdash itself. Tamad Lomar Eshabso Sai Tishmoru Ves Mikdashi Tirao. So they quote you the pasuk we just saw before. You have to guard my Mikdash, and you have to guard Shabbos and revere the Mikdash. Namra Shmira B'Shabbos V'Namra Mora B'Mikdash. The Torah uses the term guarding for Shabbos and reverence. Guarding for Shabbos and reverence regarding the Mikdash. I'm just seeing what I did here in the English. I think I made a mistake. The second word guarding there on that line is wrong. It should be revering. The Torah says guarding the Shabbos, and it says revering the Mikdash. Mashmira ha'amura b'Shabbos lo mi'Shabbos hatam b'siyarei ela mi'mi shehizir ala Shabbos. Just as you don't revere Shabbos, you revere the God who gave you Shabbos. So too, when it comes to reverence, you don't revere the Mikdash, you revere the one who created it. But the point that this is giving us is a parallel between guarding Shabbos and revering the Mikdash. They have shared identities. They're something that you guard, they're something that you revere, they're something that are intimately connected by this pasuk that we're quoting here. And as we said before, you do serve Hashem in the Beit HaMikdash on Shabbos, overriding the overriding Shabbos. So why is it that what works for the Mishkan is no good on Shabbos, the day when we're with Hashem, the day when we bring karbanos for Hashem, the day when we have this special mora, we have this special sense of reverence, and shmira, the special guarding. And really, the bigger issue, which is what I want to lead into with it, is the question that we started with. Rav Soloveitchik's comment versus the comment of Rav Lau. Right? If you look at those two, which one of those more reflects a Mishkan approach? The first one, right? The Rav Soloveitchik. He's all about creating. Whereas Rav Lau reflects... Well, the sense that there's a limit, the sense of there are certain things you don't do. On Shabbos, you don't create, you don't build, right? It's really this split. So, you tell me, right? I've been monologuing for 15 minutes. You tell me, why is it that the actions that were so valuable and so important when it came to building the Mishkan are off limits when it comes to Shabbos?
Like everything, the time and the place. Even with creation, you can do it according to Torah. And even now, I think people are encouraged to take advantage of new technology, but always under the advice of rabbis or whatever it is, halakhic authorities. And the same thing with Shabbos. It was great to build it and be a part of it. It's a silly answer, but even like if you partake in something, you're more connected to it. So that's why Hashem wanted it vis-a-vis Bnei Yisrael, right? That they should be a part of it. But I don't know.
It's like, you know, you said at the beginning that, like, you know, you don't usually think of Bereishit as being a halachic sort of sefer. But if you think about it, if you take this approach that it's the ultimate halacha, that we have to be creative, like human beings always have a tendency to take things to extremes. And so if there are limits on that first initial opening, you know, sort of like commandment to the Jewish people, then there's an understanding that there are limits in everything that we do in the world. It's the first major example. Mm-hmm. And Shabbos, and the reminder of that on Shabbos, is a continual weekly reminder of that need for moderation and limits.
Good. Okay, so...
Can you be humble then also? At one point, Bnei Yisrael could start thinking, like, look how great we are, look at what we're creating. Look at what we did and forget the whole point of building the Mishkan and who it's for, and it gets the person's head. Could it be almost like Hashem's way of not foreseeing the future, but understanding how human beings work? And, you know, the same way our religion is constantly, we make the bracha to remember the fact that this is not just an apple that we're eating. This is because Hashem allowed, like, gave us this apple. So it's kind of like to keep us on track and not get out of the game and really think that it's us that we're accomplishing this, and remember that what the bigger goal is.
Good. I think these are all great answers. Do you have anything to say? Okay. So I'm going to first go with what Donnie had said, because I think that's the first idea that I have here. And then what Hadassah and Hindi are saying, I think also fit into sort of the second and third ideas. What Donnie had suggested is creating the Mishkan had importance in and of itself. In that, you know, in that context, this was a good thing to do, but not in every context. The idea that behavior gains meaning from the context in which it takes place. That which is a good thing to do in one place is not a good thing to do in other places, right? We spend a lot of time trying to teach our children that. There are certain places where this is okay, and there are certain places where it's not okay. The Mishkan context is a positive one for Malacha, but evidently there are cases where it's not positive. You know, it reminds me of the law of the Matseva in Bereishis, where we find that Avraham creates Matseva, we find Yaakov creates a Matseva. It's a Matseva is defined usually as a single stone monument that they use as part of serving Hashem, as opposed to a Mizbeach, which is multiple stones that are combined. So look at what Ramban notes in number 7, because the Torah in Sefer Devarim says, don't create a Matseva, asher sonei Hashem Elokecha. God hates the Matseva. Well, why'd you wait till Devarim to tell me that, right? Says Ramban, Ubabaum la'aretz, when they arrived in the land, the matzeva was prohibited for them. Why? Because the Canaanim made it a greater ritual for themselves than the mizbeach, than the altar. In other words, originally Hashem was fine with it. However, the Canaanim took it and turned it into their system of worship. And so Hashem said, once Jews enter the land, I'm not interested. Don't make any matzeva for me. Or alternatively, alternatively, because Hashem didn't want to prohibit everything, so He prohibited the matzeva, He didn't prohibit the mizbeach. He's dealing with the question of Canaanim used mizbechot also. They used altars too. They didn't just have single stone monuments. So his answer is that either the Canaanim emphasized the matzeva more, that was more their representative, or alternatively, Hashem doesn't want to say, well, you can't do anything. So he says, no matzeva, but yes, mizbeach. But the idea here is, what was good for you in Bereishis is not good for you in Devarim. It's all about context. And so maybe the argument here is that there's a change in context. It's desirable to build in the Mishkan, not desirable to build on Shabbos. Why? You're creating something holy in the Mishkan? Maybe, except that you weren't allowed to build the Mishkan on Shabbos, we said. So the Mishkan didn't override Shabbos even in that context, in that situation. But that's one possible idea, is behavior is valued based on the context in which it takes place. In some places it's good, in some places it's not. A second idea, which sort of goes close to where Hindi was going with part of what you said, is that behavior gains its meaning from Hashem's command. Meaning actions are not inherently good or bad from a Jewish perspective, unless Hashem says do this or don't do this. Hashem says, build a Mishkan, now Malacha is good. Otherwise, no, it's not good. It's all based on what Hashem defines as, so to speak, right behavior. As an example of this, the issue of Shechita. There's a classic Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah, which asks, does Hashem really care whether you slaughter an animal from the front of the neck, Shechita, or the back of the neck, Arefa? Does it make any difference to God? And there are views that say it does make a difference, but in this particular medrash, it says, no, Hashem gave you the specifics of these mitzvos just litzareif es habrios, to toughen or to harden the creations, meaning, or to refine, that by following the details of what Hashem tells you to do, you develop and demonstrate your loyalty to Hashem. We've talked about that idea before. This isn't the first time we're talking about that. But take a look at the Rambam with his presentation in number 8 in the Moreh Nevuchim. He says, each general mitzvah must have a cause. And it is commanded for a particular benefit. In general, a mitzvah has a purpose. Shechita has a purpose. However, its components are just commands. For example, regarding killing a living thing for good food, the benefit is, as we will clarify, but the fact that it is performed via shechita rather than nechira, that shechita is specifically the way to kill the animal, not nechira, which is different, and severing the esophagus and windpipe in a particular spot, these and similar actions are just to refine Hashem's creations. So it only gains meaning, it gains value, because Hashem said so. That's what makes it significant. So maybe Malacha only had value when Hashem commanded it for the Mishkan. That will be a second approach. What's the weakness in this approach?
It seems so arbitrary then, and then there is no meaning to the particulars. It's just, I mean, for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, no. That's what he's saying. He's saying to you, it's not about it being arbitrary, at least in the current context. Now, Hashem wrote the Torah, Hashem declared what it's going to be, but in the sense that the only meaning that an action has is my intent that I'm doing it for God.
Right, and I think that's a difficult thing for a lot of people. You like to believe that there is a deeper meaning, even if you don't know it, right?
Like, yeah.
Something you understand, something you're like, I don't understand it, but I'm sure there's something I don't get.
Right. Now, that's for sure true, that it's a difficult idea to follow, but especially within the realm of Malacha, right? Consider this. How many categories of Malacha, then, is the Rambam proposing? What kinds of Malacha exist?
The ones with and the ones without meaning.
Right. The ones that Hashem told you to do, and the ones that Hashem did not tell you to do. The problem that you have is that it's really a binary system where you need a three-part system. Because if you're telling me I don't do malacha on Shabbos because Hashem didn't tell me to do it, Hashem also didn't tell me to do malacha on Thursday. Right? Unless I'm doing malacha that is specifically for fulfillment of a mitzvah. Right? That's not in the, so to speak, desirable category. It's only when I'm doing the malacha that is for the sake of the mitzvah. So really, everything should be up. Like, why is it specifically on Shabbos that those other things become us? Or to me, the concept of it requires that we have some kind of an intermediate category for things. It's not clear to me. Also, we again said you can't build a Mishkan on Shabbos. If you're telling me the malacha that has value is when Hashem tells you to do it, Hashem said to create the Mishkan. You could just sort of wave your hand at it and say, okay, God said this and God said that and God said both things, fine. But if I'm trying to understand the structure and understand what the system is, why is it that Hashem is telling me on Shabbos, don't do all those actions that you did to build the home for me, then I don't understand. Those actions had value. Those actions were things Hashem told us to do. And even when we were doing them originally, He said, don't do them on Shabbos. There must be a stronger opposition between Shabbos and Mishkan. It's not just, this was a command and this is a command. Like, there's got to be more to it. And I think there is. And I think it goes towards what Hadassah was saying before and what Hindi was saying as well. There's an inherent difference between Mishkan and Shabbos, such that malacha is inherently suitable for Mishkan and inherently unsuitable for Shabbos. And like all of my favorite ideas, it comes from Bereishis. You go all the way back to the beginning of the Torah and you realize what's going on. Because Adam and Chava are given two different models of serving Hashem. At the very beginning of the human adventure on earth, Adam and Chava are given two different models of serving Hashem. What are Adam and Chava told to do in the garden?
Not to eat.
Not to eat, but before that. Well, Purva was given twice. So maybe yes, maybe no before. Depends on how you look at it. When it was a bracha, when it was a mitzvah. But Hashem puts them in the garden and for a very specific purpose.
Give me that up.
And
wash it.
There you go, what?
Wash them at the garden.
There you go. Vayanicheu began Eden. Hashem put Adam in Gan Eden. Le'ovda u'le'shomra. Le'ovda means to work it.
I said wrong.
No. You said work it?
I said cultivate.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I didn't hear you. Okay, I heard you wrong. The le'ovda is to work the land, and le'shomra is to guard it. So it's unclear, and the commentaries discuss what exactly Hashem wanted them to do. The garden's there. Like, what's the concern? But even Ezra and Radak say working it is cultivation. That's what it is. And Lishomra is to guard it from the animals. Take a look. It's verse number 9. Quoting Hadassah, Radak says, Ve'nicheyu ba, he put Adam there, she'yavod ha'adamahi, for him to work that land with digging, with hoeing, with working both the vegetables and the trees, and l'shomra, to guard it from wild animals and birds, kifi kocho, according to his ability, to the extent that Adam would be capable of doing it. Le'ovda is malacha, l'shomra is guarding it, protection. Lovda is further developed when Hashem says, Mil'u'es ha'aretz, in that Puravu mitzvah, Mil'u'es ha'aretz, fill the earth, v'kiv shuha, and conquer it, settle it. Active malacha. We become both conquerors, le'ovda, and preservers, le'shomra. Yeah, we are cooperative inhabitants of an ecosystem, but we're equipped with the tools to alter it. And sometimes our role is to act, le'ovda, and sometimes our role is to be silent, le'shomra. And the challenge is to know when you're supposed to be doing each one. The value of malacha doesn't really need explanation, right? It's clear what avoda accomplishes. We understand that we can create great things, we can do great things, with our acts of work, with our acts of construction. Lo'avda is not something that a human being needs to have explained to them. Lishomra, on the other hand, is hard for people to absorb. The idea that there is meaningful service in not acting, right? The old line, those also serve who stand and wait. I don't remember where it's from anymore. But Shmira also has value as service, right? Look in the Torah. You have ases and you have los ases, right? You have your dues and you have your don't dues. The idea of Shmira, of not acting, to me the term that comes to mind is a quasi-Kabbalistic term, Tzimtzum. Right? In Tzimtzum, one restricts oneself. You hold yourself back. You choose not to act. No, Litzamtzem is to reduce. I don't think so. Tzimtzum is not so much a result of Tzimtzum is hiding. You know, Tzimtzum is used, and maybe this is what you're thinking of, in Kabbalistic thought, in terms of Hashem's presence in the world and Hester Panim, right? So Hashem is Mitzamtzem himself, whatever that means, makes himself less manifest, leaving room for everybody else. But at its core, Tzimtzum is to reduce your footprint, so to speak. It's self-censorship, right? It's choosing to be silent. You could sort of link it to Chana's tefillah, right, at the Mishkan, where she is inaudible, and we learn that tefillah is supposed to be something that is silent. The idea of Tzimtzum is not someone who is silent because they have nothing to say, but someone who is silent because they say, you know what, right now is a good time to refrain from speaking. Right? It's a decision. And even for Hashem, whether you talk about it in the Hester Panim way or not, if you take a look at number 10, I brought you Rav Yosef Albo in the Sefer HaIkarim. He's talking about that story of Eliyahu running away after Eliyahu b'Har HaKarmel, right? Eliyahu brings the karban up on Har HaKarmel. He has a showdown with the prophets of the Baal, and then Izebel wants to kill him. And Eliyahu runs away to the Midbar. He runs away to the wilderness, and he complains to Hashem, and he says, "This nation is terrible. They have violated the bris. All the criticisms that Eliyahu offers of the Jewish people." And Hashem's response is to ask him, Hashem says to Eliyahu, Malachafo Eliyahu, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? And Eliyahu gives this whole rant. And then Eliyahu is standing in a crack in the rock, and it's at Har Chorev, at Har Sinai, and there's I'm forgetting the order now, there's a sequence of, first a fire passes by, and then he's told Hashem is not in the fire, and there's a great earthquake, and Hashem is not in the earthquake, and then you finally get, after a few things have passed by, there's a wind, lo beruach Hashem, kol dmama daka, right, which we quote, unisana tokef, kol dmama daka, the small, still voice, different translations of it, it is an inherently contradictory thing. Kol is a sound. Dimama, a silence. Right? That's where they got it from, the sound of silence. That's kol dimama daka. It is a silence which is meant to convey a message to Eliyahu. And after that, Hashem says to him, again, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? Same words. And Eliyahu goes into his rant all over again. And as some of the Mefarshim read it, Hashem says, yeah, he hasn't learned his lesson. He was supposed to learn something from that experience. He didn't learn something from it. He's done. And so Hashem gives him a set of commands, which includes appointing Elisha to take over for him. There was something that he was supposed to absorb that he did not absorb. You can read this. It's all. It's in Malachim Aleph Perek Yetet. But take a look at Rav Yosef Albo on what it is that Hashem is trying to tell Eliyahu. Ralbag also has this. He says, in this great vision was hinted to Eliyahu the division of existence into three worlds. Three different worlds. And that there is one who unites, and that's talking about the three different images, the earthquake, the fire, the wind. And that there is one who unites all parts of existence. And this is Hashem. And this God is separate from them, from these worlds, utterly, hidden with the height of hiddenness, such that one cannot describe him other than with descriptions of what he is not. Which is, how do you describe? The silent, small voice. In the sense that Hashem is barely sensed, Hashem is rarely visible, Hashem is mitzamtzem himself. He doesn't impose himself on his creations. And to me, that's what Shabbos is promoting. Mishkan is easy. We're really good at doing, right? We want to be given a task and told what to do, and we're going to go ahead and do it. Maybe I'm just, you know, being a stereotypical male. Fine. just tell me what to do. Give me the job. But the other half of it, which can be a lot harder, is tzimtzum, is the Shabbos piece, when you say, I'm not going to act. I'm going to hold myself back from acting. To go back to the example I gave before with Chana and her tefillah, right? When Chana davens at the Mishkan, if you take a look at source number 11, look what the Zohar has to say about davening. He says, Man detzalitz lo say, one who prays before his master should not raise his voice in prayer. One who raises his voice in prayer will not be heard. Why? Because prayer is not the voice that is heard. And so one need not make his voice audible in his prayer, but pray silently in the voice that is not heard. This is the prayer that is always accepted. He says, Davka, the one that is silent. And it's very interesting because you find it with the Malachim. Yechezkel describes the Malachim glorifying Hashem. Yeshaya describes them glorifying Hashem out loud. Kadosh, 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 right? It was the Haftarah in Parashas Yisro. But Yechezkel describes them in Perek Aleph as mute. They don't speak out loud. On the one hand, for us, when we daven, davening may be out loud, may be better for kavana, maybe help people to concentrate more when they're actually forming words that they can hear. But at the same time, we're told that silent praise is actually the one that's most desired. There's a great irony. There's a pasuk which people say and don't actually recognize what it means. It's a pasuk in Tehillim. Biso galav ata tisha b'chem. I'm blanking on which parag it is. Anybody know? No? Okay. Then I'm in good company. The Biso galav ata tisha b'chem. When the ocean or the sea raises up its waves, you, Hashem, tisha b'chem. So, if I didn't know what I'm about to say, I would have said tisha b'chem. You praise them. Right, you're going to look it up? Yeah, you just have to type in Hebrew, that's all. The tisha b'chem doesn't mean Hashem, when the waves are raised up, then you praise them. When the waves are raised up, you silence them. You make them still. In other words, the word shevach, which we normally translate as praise, also means silence. Yeah, it's not necessarily about what you say. Sometimes it's about what you don't say. So I find that to be fascinating, that you have these two different types of service of Hashem, and with all sorts of applications. I couldn't resist Numbers 12 and 13. Really, there's other stuff I could have put on the sheet, but I liked it too much. The modern debate about activism, Zionism, same debate. Take a look at number 12, Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. Not in order to shine as a nation among nations do we raise our prayers and hopes for a reunion in our land, but in order to find a soil for the better fulfillment of our spiritual vocation in that reunion and in that land which was promised and given and again promised for observance of the Torah. He says, it's not that we want to go back to Israel in order to make our own country. It's just better to fulfill Torah there. But this very vocation obliges us, until God shall call us back to the Holy Land, to live and to work as patriots wherever He has placed us. Till we go back, remember, he's writing in Germany in the first half of the 19th century, to be patriots where we are. It obliges us further to allow our longing for the far-off land to express itself only in mourning and wishing and hoping, and only through the honest fulfillment of all Jewish duties to await the realization of this hope. But it forbids us to strive for the reunion or possession of the land by any but spiritual means. He says, you're not supposed to try to come back. You're not supposed to try to buy the land off of the Ottoman Empire. You're not supposed to try to set up colonies. Shimshon Raphael Hirsch believed, or at least promoted the idea of Tzimtzum. We're waiting for Hashem to bring us back so that we will be able to fulfill our Torah better there.
How do you know what that means, wait for Hashem to bring you back?
Well, that's the challenge in implementing this.
So, but how can you know that it doesn't mean to do what he's saying not to do?
His argument is that that's what we're commanded. I mean, he's basing himself on things like the Gemara and Ksuvos, right? Where we're told about the three Shavuos, the whole thing about not taking the land back by force. He has ample basis, you know, and certainly in his era. On the other hand, Rav Yitzchak Reines in Or Chadash Al Tzion says no. It was already envisioned regarding us from the start that the result of the pursuits and oppressions Israel would bear in its exile would be an improvement in its moral state. We now see that these pursuits have awakened and continue to awaken the Zionist ideal, at the least distancing the nation from assimilation, returning to the moral good. I'm not sure why I had that underlined. It wasn't relevant for this. Thus, there is no doubt the Zionist movement is that which they prophesied from the start. He says, the movement of activism, he's a little bit later than Rav Hirsch, is what we were supposed to do all along, what Dina is saying, which is, no, maybe this is what we're supposed to do, is the activism, is trying to buy back the land, is trying to go there, is trying to set up colonies. It's a philosophy of Le'ovda against Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's L'Shomra. You see it? So, the same thing goes back to now, obviously, Rav Lau and the Rav. Right? Rav Lau is arguing for L'Shomra, a more passive position. Rav Soloveitchik is arguing, no, L'Ovda. Hashem created and it's a model for us. And I think that's the same idea regarding Malacha and the Mishkan. And this goes sort of back to what Hindi was saying before, I think, as well as to what Hadassah was saying. The Mishkan is a realm of human creativity. And we actively convert the world into a home for Hashem. That's what we're doing. That's L'Ovda. It was vital in creating the Mishkan. That's what we had to do. However, the human being also has to know a day of Tzimtzum. I think one of you used the word humility. A day when you're not creating. Certain experiences are best done in silence. And that bonding with Hashem that occurs on Shabbos is something best expressed in silence.
Is that what Shamal V'Zachor would be?
Mm-hmm. Possibly. The reason I say possibly is because there's a lot you can do with Shamar and Zachor. Like, Zachor is usually understood as about the preparations you do in advance for Shabbos, as opposed to anything done that day. So I guess... Sorry? Right, at the beginning and at the end. It is on Shabbos, it's true. But usually when you look at how do you fulfill Zachor, it's usually prepare your clothing, prepare the house, prepare food. It's all the things that you do prior to, even though you're right, Zachorayu al Hayayin, you do say Kiddush on Shabbos proper. Even without the point of Kiddush, I think you could make the argument that the L'Ovda of Shabbos is what happens during the 6 days. It's not happening on that day itself. L'Ovda in advance and L'Shomra on that day.
Mm-hmm. So there's only certain things we don't do regarding the Mishkan, but there are certain things, like you said, you bring Karbanos on Shabbos, and there are certain things you do.
Yes. That's correct. In other words...
How does that fit? Yeah.
So I think...
Is it literal silence? Like you're bringing the Karban and... That's still in silence because you're not actively working, but it is kind of...
So it's funny, because there actually were, if you go back to the days of the Gemara, there is a position that says that Shabbos is supposed to be a day of silence. One of the Amoraim, I want to say Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai, but I'm not sure I'm remembering correctly, it's in the Yerushalmi, We're told that when his mother would speak a lot on Shabbos, he would remind her, you know, it's Shabbos, Mom. We don't speak a lot. He did it, I'm sure, in the most honoring and respecting of ways. But there is this idea, in fact, of silence, even though there clearly is a presence of avoda. We are bringing the karbanos, and there's no way around that. Maybe the point indeed is that there's no such thing as 100%. In other words, the world can't have a world in which we are 100% avoda, and it can't have a 100% shmira either. You know, there must be an element of shmira even during the week then, because you also can't have a world that's 100% avoda. There must be also an element of tzimtzum going on during the week too. To me, though, this is a very important and I think powerful idea in terms of the way we think about ourselves and our role in this world. You know, it's so much beyond the narrow issue of the what we're going to get as a director out of this parsha, because sometimes we're fortunate and we have a direct command, right? They were told, build a mishkan. Here's what you do. I know I am told to do certain things. I'm told to daven. I'm told to make a bracha. I'm told to whatever it is. I have an element of avoda, right? All the acts of chesed that we're involved with are fundamentally avoda. Hashem said, go ahead and do it. It's not always so easy, right? Whether you're talking about scientific advances in genetic engineering, or whether you're talking about how you daven, or whether you're talking about Zionism, all those areas, it's a much more sensitive type of a judgment call that you have to make in terms of what you're supposed to do and what you're not supposed to do. You know, to digress for a moment, actually, I don't know if I can digress for a moment. I want to do review questions instead. I'll hold the digression. The digression has been Sarah Mora. Maybe I'll do it in the follow-up email. We'll see. But I have to go to a conference call very shortly. But review questions that I didn't get to put on the sheet. How do we see that human beings run the creation of the Mishkan? So we collected and donated the funds. We created the structure. We created the vessels. We created the clothing of the Kohanim. We did the avoda of dedication. In what three ways do we say that Shabbos and Mikdash coexist? They're both about the Shekhinah being among us. They are linked in terms of conduct that expresses this reverence for Hashem and the Torah's command of Tiro, of having Mora. And the fact that Avoda happens even on Shabbos. So we suggested that maybe the reason why you aren't supposed to do those acts on Shabbos is because the context of those acts is important. Excuse me. Like with the Matzeva, the context of creating the Mishkan makes the Malacha important, but if you're not creating the Mishkan, then not. The problem with that is you didn't create the Mishkan on Shabbos. Maybe because Hashem said to do it, that's what makes it special. Or maybe it's about these two opposing approaches to serving Hashem. Action on one hand, avoda, and shmira tzimtzum on the other. Last source that I brought you here just confirms this approach. Avos Rabbi Nasan, expansion of Pirkei Avos. Bashvi'i mahu omer, what song do you sing on the seventh day? Mizmor shir li yom haShabbos. Yom shekulo Shabbos, the day that is entirely Shabbos. She'im bo lo achila lo shesia lo masu matan. There's no eating, there's no drinking, there's no commerce. What happens then? Tzadikim yoshvin atrosayim barashayim b'nen emiziv hashchina. They simply sit, crowns on their heads, nourished by the radiance of the Shechina. That's the ultimate Shmira. Right? That's the... Sorry? No eating or drinking. No need to eat or drink.
By
the Tzadikim. This is a reference to... This is the Gemara. On what life is like in Olam Haba. Yeah. Not Shabbos like what's happening 2 days. No. Eat or drink then. But I think this is a really important idea for us to develop a conscious type of malacha and a conscious type of tzimtzum, and to discern where we're supposed to do each. Okay.
Thank you.